All right, everybody, thank you so much for coming. We're going to go ahead and get started. This is session 222, titled An Alternative Orthodoxy for Mormonism. The session is being recorded, and audio will be available for purchase at the Sunstone Audio Desk after the session, just as a reminder. So a little bit about the session. There's a lot of big words here, so I'm going to do my best. Dr. Richard Rohr, OFM, a prominent Catholic priest, writer, and teacher, has referred to his Franciscan teachings as an alternative orthodoxy that, quote, doesn't throw out the mainline tradition. It simply places our effort and our energy on overlooked and misunderstood aspects of the tradition, unquote. So in this session, we will use Rohr's alternate orthodoxy. Sorry, mess up on one word. I feel like I mess up on all of them. We're gonna use the Rohr's alternate orthodoxy as a guide to explore what an alternative orthodoxy might look like in the Mormon tradition if we emphasize certain aspects of the radical wisdom teachings of Jesus of Nazareth combined with the mystical teachings of Joseph Smith. What might the approach open up for spiritual seekers and younger Mormons who are feeling a disconnect in today's LDS church? Janice Spangler is a certified integral professional coach. She works with Symmetry Solutions, where she specializes in working with individuals and couples affected by faith transition and the resulting impacts on identity, relationship, and spirituality. She is a student at the Living School and the Center for Action and Contemplation under the direction of Richard Frohr, OFM, Cynthia Borgeau, and James Finley, where she studies contemplative wisdom traditions and how they can help deepen our engagement with the world from the truest self. So just as a reminder, we will have an hour. So we'll try and leave some time at the very end for Q&A. And at the end, when we are done, you know, if we can take a lot of the questions outside so that we're not interrupting the next session, that would be phenomenal. Thanks, everyone.
Okay, so as was mentioned, I am a student at the Living School with Father Richard Rohr. And I'm finding him to be someone that a lot of people is resonating with a lot of us in progressive Mormonism. And I've been in this school for 2 years. I'm actually graduating next week from the school. And as I've been there and taken in the offerings of Richard Rohr, I just continually sit there and say, how can this apply to my tradition? How can this apply to Mormonism? And the more I've been there, the more I realize that there is so much in our tradition that is so rich with some of these mystical teachings, which actually at first really ticked me off in the middle of my deconstruction. I didn't want Joseph Smith to have wisdom. I didn't want it. But I've had to admit that there's something there. And so I just wanted to share some of this with you. I mean, most of this, I'm just going to tell you, ripped off completely from Richard. And I've just made tweaks that brings in our particular tradition. But just want to explore what this might open up for us with so many of us who are feeling like, I don't know. For me, in my faith journey, it just started feeling small. I guess that's the best way that I can explain it. And my purpose in this is just how can we mine the depths again, because they are there. Okay, so just quick little background. I'm going to try to get through this quickly so that we have some good Q&A. But, you know, there have always been mystics. There have been people communing with the divine all throughout our human history. And there's kind of a life cycle that goes with religions that end up sticking around, at least for a little while. You've got the mystic who has this ineffable experience, has this little, you know, view of transcendence and tapping into something bigger than themselves, whatever that is. And then if that person has, you know, some personality and some communication, then other people start to see what's happening and the transformation that happens with that mystic, and they get interested. And if the tradition is going to survive at all, then you have to have people who are ordered, who bring order to the whole thing, right? And when we bring order, often we bring dogma. We like to have our certainty, and we like to have our little boxes that make us feel safe. And so it's not too long that some of these mystical underpinnings start to get lost in us trying to get a handle on what is actually happening and trying to define God in dualistic ways that our minds can handle. So you see this over and over and over again. And so as I've opened up to some of this, I'm realizing how necessary restoration is. So I never refer to it as the restoration. I think all things are in a constant state of restoration, because we are constantly separating ourselves from that source of the divine because of our rational dualistic minds. So that's just a little intro. I also just want to introduce this concept of growing consciousness over time, both with individuals and with groups. This has been studied pretty extensively over the last 50, 60 years, with spiral dynamics and other developmental theorists, Fowler. It all kind of fits into this idea that our consciousness grows over time. We just become more and more aware of bigger and bigger things. We're aware of ourselves, we're aware of our groups, we're aware of more of the world, then we're aware of the planet. I mean, as we grow in adulthood, our consciousness expands. So if you look at kind of the primary, I would say, the thing that motivates the highest value of these particular levels of consciousness, this is just one model, I would suggest that in most organized religion in the West, and particularly in Mormonism, we are somewhere between the blue and orange stages, somewhere in there. Really, we value order, we value certainty, we value conformity, and we love success. We love to climb the ladder. We love achievement. And so we're somewhere in there with the center of gravity. This is where dogma really thrives. This is where this, like, ordered, make me safe, tell me how to do things. When the majority of the people in a group are there, that's where this thrives. So, but what I'm seeing with the progressive is that we are moving more and more into the green. We're moving more into this place. There are people on the leading edge who are experiencing this, and this is why things just start to feel a little rigid to some of us who are experiencing this developmental growth. And then also just to say that, waking up experiences, transcendent experiences, can happen at any level, but it is going to affect how we interpret that experience. So if we're in a place that is very tribal in our development and we have an experience with God, we might say, God is just for us, not for them, for example. If you're at a higher level of consciousness, you might recognize that experience that you've had maybe applies to other people as well. If you're at a really low place, you might just say, I am God. Paradoxically, if you're at a really high place, you also might say, I'm God, but whole different thing. So these are just a few of the traits of the higher stages. These are some of the things that start to happen. We become aware of this. We become aware that there's developmental growth. We become aware of other perspectives. The literal need for the literal falls away, and we start leaning into myth and paradox. And there's diversity is celebrated, inclusion. We start looking at transformational for our religious lives rather than just the transactional. We have a desire for purpose. We really see this in the studies with millennials, right, with Jan Arise's work and others, that there's a desire for purpose over rote worship. Don't just give me the rules. Tell me why. Give me a good reason for this. There's a resonance with theology over doctrine. We are a very doctrine-driven church. There is theology there, but it's not been emphasized for a very long time. Here are the rules, do the things, and you're good, right? The higher stages also learn to value leadership over authority. In between there, we kind of throw out authority and we just, we just want to be free of all of it. Don't any, you know, we're very individualist. Don't tell me what to do. But eventually we start to realize that leadership is actually necessary to keep things together. And we value belonging over fitting in. It's that conformity starts, that need for conformity starts to fall away. And we just want to show up as our authentic selves and be known and have that be okay. So with that in mind, I'm going to just dive right into his 7 points of his Richard Rohr's alternative orthodoxy. So like I said, I've just tweaked words here and there to make it a little more Mormon because his is very Catholic. He uses things like incarnation and Trinity and all kinds of things that make us kind of go, huh? That's bad stuff, right? We don't like Trinity. Okay, so first he talks about his methodology. So this is definitely one I've tweaked to be less Catholic and put in Mormon words like personal revelation. So personal revelation as validated by scripture and prophetic revelation. And you notice I say prophetic revelation. It's not just revelation by the prophet, because I think with our alternative orthodoxy, we need to start to recognize that there are prophetic voices everywhere. This is definitely there in our tradition. Joseph Smith was often quoted as saying he wishes for all of us to be prophets in our own affairs. So he was definitely looking for us to have this connection. But we've been having a fight ever since. And really, even it started with Joseph, but it really, really, you know, Brigham really clamped down on this, that this personal revelation versus prophetic revelation, which one do we preference? And it's a fight that's going to be ongoing for quite some time, I'm sure. So this is a good guide for our spiritual view, how we view the world, how we take in things. Richard talks about it as a tricycle. He talks about his word for personal revelation experience is the front wheel, because we can't get away from our own experience, our own personal revelation. Whether we recognize it or not, we're seeing the world through our view. We don't see the world as it is. We see the world as we are. But if you are getting personal revelation that is maybe completely different from anything you've ever seen in a wisdom tradition or in our tradition or in scripture, you might want to take a second look at what you think you're receiving. So this is what I think our tricycle historically is looking like. It's got a really, really big front wheel, and it is being led by prophetic revelation. And I think because of the stage of development we're in, it feels really good. We can be sure. Well, they said it. So rock on. Like, I don't have to think about it. I don't think we think of it that way, and we give this, like, no, you've got to be sure for yourself. I mean, that's there. But in practice, so often we are just like, no, I don't really want to think about it. You know, if something is a little off with me with what's happening, I'll just go with what they say. I'm safe. I'm safe that way. We'll never be led astray. It's good. And we speak to the scripture and personal revelation, but typically it's in a way to prop up the prophetic revelation. So what I would suggest is that if we are going to mature in our spirituality and in our theology, we are going to need to, first of all, really shrink that front wheel and swap it out and lead with personal revelation. I mean, I think that the big wheel of authority is probably an appropriate thing in early stages of development. You know, you want parents to listen to, you want wise people to kind of give you a foundation. It is a very safe, very nice way to grow up, to have an identity, and to gain values. But at some point, if you are going to be a really self-determining person, really know yourself, and really engage in the world in important ways, I think we need to have that personal revelation preferenced as guided by other bigger sources so we don't get really off in the weeds, right? Okay, so next is foundation. So this is a really important one. If Jesus is all human and all divine, and is one in purpose with the Father, then this is a benevolent universe. God is not someone to be feared and is on our side. Our humanness is to be embraced rather than overcome. There is so much in our theology that supports this. You know, at the time, this was one of the things that ticked me off. at the time of Joseph Smith, in the place that he came up in all of this really thick Protestantism, this idea of Jesus was that Jesus, this was propagated by Luther, is that Jesus is all divine, we are all human, I'm a pile of crap, but Jesus can save me. We must always be supplicating and really heavy on atonement theory. And one of the things that I see in the Restoration is that Joseph Smith brought us this idea that we are not substantially different from Jesus, that the Christ is all human, all divine, literally, in a way that most traditions don't have, and we are as well. We are human, and we have divine DNA. You know, we are intelligences in our essence, co-created with God. And if that is the case, then and Jesus is the face of that, and we see his life, we see his sacrifice, we see everything that is there with Jesus. Then, who is to fear Christ? You know, Christ was all about love. He was all about just benevolence and love. And so if that is the face of what God is and his purpose, then we can rest in that, that God is on our side. He actually likes us. I think so often the only thing we want to give to Jesus today in our tradition about his humanness is, well, it let him die. He wouldn't have died otherwise because he's a God. But we don't really want to embrace that he was human, that he really had human traits. We make him into perfection in a way that is very Protestant, actually. We think that perfection means absolutely no sin, and I think we've really misinterpreted that. So I would love to see us get back to this idea of our inner divinity, that we all carry the divine DNA, and when that's the case, you really have this ability to, have a better esteem in yourself. Something that happens with when we get so into sin, and I really we owe a lot to Terrell and Fiona Givens for the direction they're taking us with this. They're recognizing in The Christ Who Heals, they're really recognizing this idea that we have taken our Protestant ideas about Christ to an unhealthy place. And we aren't really understanding what Joseph Smith was trying to restore. But when God is not on your side or hates your humanness, it is really hard to heal. You know, I think that's when we see our scripture, a natural man is an enemy to God, I think we are actually misinterpreting that. And I'm going to get to that later on. I have a different view of what that scripture means. Rather than making any part of ourselves the enemy, how can we include our humanness and have that, and realize that there is no perfection without including our humanity, because there is no perfection in the way that we've framed it so far in Mormonism. Okay, let's get to the frame. Okay, so framing. There is only one reality. Any final distinction between natural and supernatural, religion and science, sacred and profane, is an artificial construct. If something is true, we will get there regardless of the vehicle. So as I said, we all carry the divine DNA. If God is creating this, then it all has to be natural law in some way. We don't have to separate like this supernatural power. We get there, again, in our stages of consciousness from a pre-rational place. And the way I like to explain this pre-rational, rational, and trans-rational is with the idea of a rainbow. So in a pre-rational state, we will look at a rainbow and say, oh, God is bestowing his grace on us. Look at that. He's smiling at us. This is beautiful. That's what causes a rainbow, is God's benevolence. We'll get into it in our consciousness. We start to understand science. We start to have more rational thinking. And suddenly a rainbow is light refracted through water. And we understand all of that. And, you know, there's a lot of truth in that and a lot of certainty, and it's great. Not a lot of magic. When we get to open up to a transrational way of being, then we can allow in what that looks like is, yes, it includes the prior. Yes, we understand the science of it. We don't deny that at all. And as I'm sitting here looking at it, I am feeling a transcendent connection to something bigger than myself that I don't quite understand. Right? And so often when we're caught in this rational state, we deny anything that we cannot ratify and explain through our evolution and our science as pre-rational. We throw the baby out with the bathwater. But if there is only one reality, then we can include all of it. If it's true, we're going to get there. It doesn't matter if you get there through science. Just because we have a transrational view doesn't make the rational any less true. We already have some elements of this within the tradition. You know, truth is circumscribed into one great whole. And even when we talk about grace, we don't have to talk about grace as something supernatural, if like some additive magic power that does something to us. Grace can just come naturally to us by the fact of the DNA of the divine within us. And we can just look at Christ as our access to that, of understanding. Okay. Another way to look at this is the Buddhist parable of the elephant. I'm sure so many of us have heard this, where if you had a bunch of different people from different cultures blindfolded, and you had their hand on an elephant, and you're trying to have them explain reality, and one has the hand on the trunk, and they're trying to explain what God and reality is, they're going to explain it very differently than someone who's holding an ear, right? But so there are many, many ways to get to this one reality. That's my point. Okay. Next is ecumenism. Oh boy, I'm going to speed things up, get less verbose here. So ecumenism, everything belongs. No one needs to be scapegoated or excluded. Darkness only needs to be named and exposed truthfully as it dies in exposure to light. We have a lot of ecumenism in the theology. Joseph was wanted Mormonism. He's described Mormonism as the repository of all truth, regardless of where it comes from. If it comes from the heathen, if it comes from other creeds, it does not matter. We are just going to take all of it. He did not in any way think that all of it was going to come through him and we should deny all other truth that we see or find it suspect. Again, because of our stage of development that we've grown up in, you know, it's much easier to fire people up over difference than commonality, actually. You know, all you have to do is call something else a threat and people band together faster than anything else. And really, we don't have to beat each other up over theology. We don't have to beat each other up over what someone else believes. All you really need to do is show a better way and invite goodness and invite truth. And when you do that, the rest becomes manifest over time. We don't need to get into the arguments. So, ecumenism. Next one is transformation. So, to me, these next two are at the heart of what could really, really transform us into something that would be really, really meaningful in the world. So, the separate self is the problem. Where, and meaning the separate self, what I mean by the separate self is that part of our ego and our personality that is wanting to be separate, superior, loved, looked well at. I'm calling that the separate self, as opposed to this divine connection within us that is already connected to the divine. But we're a little blind to that. Our rational minds hide it from us. And so that's the problem, is that we forget that we are acting from our separate self most of the time. Religion and most people make the shadow self the problem, the woundedness, the problems that we have, the frailties. And what this does is it leads to denying, pretending, and projecting instead of real transformation into the divine. We need to do our shadow work. That's what we mean by this. We deny our shadow. We deny our weaknesses. We make it the enemy. The natural man is an enemy to God. But I think if we define that natural man as the separate self, it's those moments when we forget that we're divine. That's where all problems come up. That's where we start being cruel to one another. And that's where we get offended, because I don't want you to step on my sacred cow of what makes me feel good about myself, right? And again, we have this, even in the Book of Mormon, we have this, Ether 1227, if you come to me, I will show you your weakness. I think we are meant to include. Again, this is part of not denying our humanness, not thinking that being human is somehow making us unworthy, right? But we, Christianity, this is not just Mormonism, we have done very little to look at the ego. We have done very little to recognize how it drives us. We give lip service to humility. But, you know, there was a study done, a broad study on narcissism, and the group that had the highest level of narcissism was clergy. And when you think about that, that is not a surprise. You know, you've got everyone telling you you're wonderful, looking up to you, and you're surrounded by yes men, and now you think that you speak for God. So I love it when Richard says, the only thing worse than a separate self is a Christian separate self. Because now I've got God telling me that I'm right in the way I'm doing it. And really, only those who end up embracing their shadow break through. That is our access to grace. And only the people who are going to include that are the ones who really let the empathy in and break through to be able to do good and heal others. Because when you're transformed, you have no need to be special or to gain approval from other people. So, and it's not that we need to kill our ego. It's not that our ego needs to die. We just need to recognize it and how it's driving us. Okay. Next is process. The path of descent is the path of transformation. Our primary teachers, I love this, our primary teachers are darkness, failure, relapse, death, and woundedness rather than ideas or doctrines. The ideas and the doctrines all happen here, right? The experience is what makes it real. That's what gives us access to the compassion. You know, Jesus was the prime example of this. Jesus descended below all, and we as Christians have been trying to climb back up where he came down ever since. So it's, we've been doing in Christianity elevator theology, which was never the gospel. Our own private perfection project was never part of this. And there's a lot of great stuff in the DNC Liberty Jail that speaks to this, of what good can come from descent. So what would happen if we stopped making our problems the problem? What if we recognized that as an essential part of our transformation and our elevation? And there's a whole I would talk to anyone for days about this. This will be a whole different session sometime. But this is where the wisdom of liberation theology comes in, where we recognize that the people who have the privilege of being on the elevator and trying to perfect themselves, it is because of their privilege. People on the margins, the poor, those who are on the margins of society have a leg up in understanding the gospel. We're disadvantaged when we can make ourselves the perfection project. We are privileged. So, okay, finish up here with the goal. So, what would we make the goal of religion if it's not our private perfection? We need to realize that reality is paradoxical and complementary, okay? It is paradoxical. We don't like to see that. Our dualistic minds want to make buckets. It's true, it's false. It's this, it's that. It's either or. It's us versus them. Things are true, you know, all true, all false. But that's not reality. Reality is far more complex. The older we get, the more we know this. The older we get, the less we know. When we are wise, it's an emptying. When we know less. So the goal really is divine union. It's remembering who we are. It's remembering that piece of ourselves, that we're part of something bigger, rather than a private perfection project. This should be the goal of all religion. And it should be our goal. If you can't deal with paradox and mystery, then you're going to stay in an endless fight with something. There's this thing that they talk about with the Law of Three, which is you have an affirming and a denying force. We see this in our politics. We see this in religion. We see this with everything. We see this within our communities. Is it true? Is it false? I'm going to argue with you over, you know, history for 5 years so we can figure out which is right. We're all about what is right. That's our dualistic mind. We need to bring the paradox and the non-dual experience back to our religion. It's about experience. It's about connection. So when you have just two forces, nothing new is created. You have to have a third force to break through that and create anything new. And that third way is completely, we're blind to it with a dualistic mind. And just one quick example of that was from the life of Jesus. He was a perfect example of paradox. I could, again, I've got slides on this. We're going to skip them. But Christ's teachings were completely paradoxical. The woman taken in adultery, they bring her. Should we stone her? The dualistic way is just tell them yes or no. Yeah, no, don't do it. The thing that brings the enlightenment, the thing that brings the new thought is him giving the third way of his answer being, look at yourselves first. Look inward, right? So let's look at ways, if we can tap into, this is the whole purpose of the Living School, if you can tap into that true self, if you can tap into the divine that is within you by getting quiet and contemplative, then we have whole new solutions to issues in the world. If we can have this kind of a view, what force for good could Mormonism be? The seeds are there. The seeds are there in our theology. We've just kind of misinterpreted and misunderstood, in my opinion. So I'll just end with this little quote here, which I love. The important thing is not to think so much, but to love much. And so do that which best stirs you to love. Thank you. Yes, please.
So for questions, because this is being recorded, if you come up and use the mic, that'd be awesome.
Hi, and thank you. So because we see the world as we are, and we're trying to evolve and transform into something else that we can't yet see, we might be able to define it, but not necessarily know what it looks like for us. What do you do about that? How do you then reach for something that you're aware is there, but even the reaching for it creates... It changes it, right? Because, like, for example, you don't reach for mystical experiences. You don't reach for transcendent experiences. But at the same time...
We try. We really like to try.
Right. So, yeah. But what... If you could talk a little bit about that process and nail it down maybe just a tiny bit more. Just whatever you got.
It's a bit ethereal for sure. We need a whole new session on practices to access this, right? So my really quick answer would be contemplation. And it goes back to that first slide of personal revelation. We call it personal revelation. I call it a contemplative connection to the divine, right? But when we get more comfortable we have to be able to reach into some higher levels of development to even access this, because at lower levels, we just want the certainty. Show me how to do it. What's next? I need the goal. You know, I need to know. The paradoxical is about mystery. It's about not knowing and being comfortable with that and just being willing to be led. And when we get really quiet, those are the instances we set up. We don't make the mystical experience happen, but we set up the parameters and the conditions that would allow it to happen. So it's learning to sink into an allowing of what is and trusting what arises. And so it's really going deeply into personal revelation and deep connection with our true selves.
So I just want to talk a minute about the spiral dynamics you had on there. And that when you're trying to live out in community, you're going to have people in all of those different levels. And even within yourself, certain things happen and you kind of, you know, move in between the different levels. And so what does Richard, what does he kind of talk about is living that out in community so that you can have respect for each other and not look down on each other or look up, you know, what I mean?
Stinking hard, right? If you are not in the center of gravity of your group, heaven help you, right? It's hard. And it is part of this, again, this contemplative journey in tapping into the true self, right? Because the true self, Richard often says this, the true self cannot be offended. The reason it's really hard is that we still have all of this identity in that place where everyone else is of being the same. We need to be samesies, right? We have a lot to learn as a culture about how to hold differentiation. But guess what? That's not part of the center of gravity where we are. So all we can do, really, if you're on a leading edge, if you're somewhere on the outside of that center, is to work on ourselves, look inward, and try to open through love. It's really the only thing that will ever... Ideas never changed anybody. Telling everyone all of the logical reasons why we should be inclusive of our LGBT brothers and sisters is not going to change anybody's mind, but knowing someone and desperately loving someone who is LGBT will. It's that. It's the heart. The transformation comes through here, and we are far too, in the West, we are far too much here. And we don't recognize where our ego is making us look down on everybody else, right? So the best we can do is speak to this and just try to bring us all to a higher place of moving and acting through love.
A comment and then a question. I'm slow.
A little closer. There you go.
I'm slow. This sounds like the movie Inside Out.
It's not unlike it. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Love it.
But I get there. There are echoes here for me of Lowell Bunyan, Truman Madsen, Neil Maxwell. Oh, yeah, and Sterling McMurrin. Sterling McMurrin, your favorite person. Now, it's fascinating.
Yeah.
No matter where you go in the world, this is where everybody ends up.
That's right.
The question is,
yeah.
I don't disagree you have to love from the inside out. And I don't disagree it is a complete energy experience. But often, those that you are broadcasting to don't hear.
Correct.
Do you agree, however, that they do feel, and over time those feelings accumulate and heal?
Absolutely.
So that's essentially what this is about.
Absolutely. And we are all on that progression. It's just slow for groups.
No, it's slow for old men. Thanks.
Yeah, it's slower for groups. Thank you. Yes, I totally agree.
Hi.
So
how do you see this kind of integrated on an institutional level, specifically for religious organizations? Especially because they cast a wide net. They cover a wide community of individuals that are at different places in their own development, right?
Yep.
So how can they have a universally accessible message that promotes this kind of development and growth that you're talking mm-hmm. about. Mm-hmm. And are there any religious institutions today that you see doing this in particularly effective ways that mm-hmm. should be modeled?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah, so, I mean, I think this... these points of alternative orthodoxy is how we get there. We've got to back off of the strict doctrine, recognize it for what it is in formation, but make it wider. We've got to, you know, broaden this and stop being so doctrinaire. Get back to theology and knowing God. I mean, it's the study of God, you know. It's not trying to explain exactly what that is. It's living into the mystery, right? As far as places doing it, more and more are, but they're still rare. And, you know, I'm aware of some congregations that are mainly through my connection at the Living School, because those are the people that this is pulling, right? So there are some organizations in some different cities. I know I'm aware of one in Denver. I mean, I would say that the Living School is one of them. They're modeling how to use this theology and how to do good in the world through inner transformation. So they're a great place to start if you're interested in seeing what's going on out there. But it's catching on. It's an exciting time. I think that we're going to be seeing more and more and more and more of this. I went to a great session with John Hamer yesterday, where they're talking, you know, the Church for the Unchurched, and he's talking about this a lot in his community in Community of Christ in Toronto. So I once you start opening your eyes to this, you will see echoes of it. You definitely will.
Mine is kind of a follow-up to that and mm-hmm. some things I've been pondering. Mm-hmm. Because the most intimate, vulnerable, emotional, tearful, sacred experience I've had, as I think back throughout my life, like one of them was in with Truman Madsen in mm-hmm. the general store in Nauvoo, when it was just a small group and there mm-hmm. was just this, you know, sharing, and mm-hmm. he was talking about the first endowment, and mm-hmm. and then I think about like we go to yoga retreats, and when you're gathered in a small group and you're sharing and you're exchanging ideas and you're mm-hmm. able to, you know, be vulnerable, and mm-hmm. and so I know that this has been talked about in the mm-hmm. church, and this is where I feel like in our local, because I'm just curious to get people's thoughts on, like, mm-hmm. in their local, because I'm in Arizona, mm-hmm. and, you know, we've had, like, with the Relief Society Sisters, a small gathering, like, with yoga, and then, you know, people open up and share, and there's mm-hmm. vulnerability, and there's, mm-hmm. and so I know that, like, the church talked about at one point with, you know, kind of mimicking the addiction recovery and doing that mm-hmm. in Relief Society mm-hmm. with the circle. Yep. We tried that for a while.
Yep.
I don't know how many do that anymore.
Yep.
And then also, because a lot of Christian churches now, and I'm sure John Hamer talked about this, are gathering mm-hmm. in their homes
yep.
with smaller groups. Groups, mm-hmm. you know, that's what I'm mm-hmm. would like to see the church doing, and I think we're all mm-hmm. trying to figure out how to do that in our local area without breaking mm-hmm. rules, because it used to be against the rules to do something in your home,
yeah. Yeah.
but now with firesides and yeah. gatherings,
yeah.
So what do you think about, you know, somehow creating those small groups, intimate yeah. circles?
I mean, I think it's necessary. I do think that this, you know, the Brené Brown, the vulnerability, all that, it's leaking into our collective consciousness, and I think it is the way forward. It's the way to safely, and I think recovery groups are doing this. This is why it works. Because they are doing this in smaller groups and not running from the shadow. They're bringing it to the light. They're working, they're integrating the tough, dark places, right? So I think we do need to see more and more of this in order to do the transformation and process parts of the this alternative orthodoxy. There's real power in it. And, you know, if you're not doing anything better at 5 o'clock, I'm going to be part of a panel where we're prognosticating on where the church will be in 30 years. And, spoiler alert, there's some of that in what I'm going to say. So, yeah.
I kind of feel like this was a really good Sunday school lesson, something that you go away from really thinking a lot. What I wondered is if you can recommend any books or articles that mm-hmm. would go into this more deeply.
Absolutely. So Richard Rohr has a number of books that are amazing with this. Falling Upward, Immortal Diamond, his brand new one, Universal Christ. Highly recommend. And he's actually got a podcast that goes along with that where he discusses with some of his staff each chapter of Universal Christ. I would highly recommend that. It's called Another Name for Everything, which I love. let's see, off the top of my head. The Naked Now, that's another Richard Rohr, yeah. Also, just to get this wisdom part of who Jesus is and the social justice part of Jesus, Cynthia Bourgeot is another faculty member at the Living School, and she has one called The Wisdom Jesus. And she's also written a book on the Law of Three. So those are a couple that you might want to look at. Yeah. Braving the Wilderness. Okay, yes. Braving the Wilderness. This is going to be getting into that shadow work and inner transformation is the work of Brené Brown. And Braving the Wilderness is definitely those of us who are questioning, how do we be part of this thing that I don't belong in? It's great. It's great for practical things. Yeah. Anyone else? Oh, yeah, Richard Rohr does have a daily devotional. You're going to get a lot of this kind of alternative orthodoxy in his daily email. So you go to his website, cac.org. That's for the Center for Action and Contemplation. And there's a tab on there for his daily meditations. They're free. You just get an email in your inbox each morning, and it has wonderful wisdom contained in it. Yeah.
He also has, with some of the books... Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
But like a class online.
Yeah. The CAC is having more and more online classes. There's one just coming up really soon with Cynthia Bourgeot, an introduction to Wisdom School. And there's one with Jim Finley and Mirabai Starr also coming up. So that might be a really good place to go. Yeah.
That's like 4 years of reading. Can you give me
Yeah. Don't you have that? You want a good place to start? I would probably recommend Universal Christ and Falling Upward if you want to get a really good kind of foothold into it. Okay. Yeah.
I don't know if we have any more time, but I just follow up on that. I read Falling Upward, uh-huh. and he talks about the second half of life, and I like really what you talked about there, where, you know, I grew up in a tradition, I'm sure a lot like all of us did, in a very rule-following. We were rewarded. We were comfortable. Mm-hmm. Very dualistic, us, mm-hmm. them, yep. I'm right, you're wrong, yep. et cetera, et cetera. As we move more into this liminal space and mm-hmm. as we move into more of this non-dualistic,
yep.
I find myself being very lonely.
Yes.
You know, I go to my church, try to participate, and everybody wants to go back to that point.
Yep.
But I don't want to go back there. It's frankly boring.
Yeah. You know, we want to go back into the matrix, man.
I'm bored of it.
Yeah.
So you become very lonely and
yes.
you feel like you don't fit in.
Yes.
The other thing that I would point out is, you know, mm-hmm. I've got aging parents who mm-hmm. are close to death who mm-hmm. are validating that mm-hmm. in hyper mode that I've mm-hmm. never seen before in life before.
Yeah.
So it's hard to relate to them.
Yeah.
How do we deal with that loneliness and how do you deal with that moving forward?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, it is such a lonely path. And I think it's a combination of acceptance, living into acceptance of that. Again, recognizing it's our ego that needs a lot of that. But, you know, I think we all need community. We are part of community. It is a part of us. And so I don't even necessarily think that's just an ego need. But it's reaching out to other people and finding support in that. It's a very, very lonely road and hard to do on our own. So find communities, find like-minded people. The internet brings us together in ways that is really lovely. So, you know, start getting connected to the CAC and to, you know, there's a lot of this going on in the internet world of progressive Mormonism. So start to connect to others. It's vital. It's really vital.
Another title by a Protestant professor of theology, recommended mm-hmm. to me by Gloria Reis, is Peter Enns,
yes.
The Sin of Certainty.
It's a wonderful book. Thank you for that. That is a wonderful resource. The Sin of Certainty, Peter Enns. Yep.
I would just observe that I've noticed perhaps somewhat recently that I'm more comfortable with loneliness, and it's not all bad.
Thank you. It's the path of descent, right? Leads to transformation. So, yeah, I mean, we spend a lot of, on that note, we spend a lot of time in our Christian life trying to control and avoid the hard edges, right? We just don't get this. We try to avoid rather than include. This is something that we can really integrate and learn from the Eastern philosophies and from our Buddhist brothers and sisters. That's part of the ecumenism, right? This needs to go beyond just Christianity. Ecumenism, we need to bring other traditions in and see how they're doing it. Because honestly, in my own work as a life coach, I'm telling you, the Buddhists have an understanding of suffering and acceptance and using that for a good that we have not tapped into in our thought, even though it is there. It is there in our theology, but we haven't tapped into it because of the way we've interpreted things.
Earlier in Q&A, you mentioned something about something is not, cannot be offended. What was that statement again?
Okay, yeah, the separate self, or the true self. Basically, that's that part of us with that divine DNA that's just, yeah.
So I wanted to kind of bounce on that. It reminded me of a podcast episode that you did with Dan Witherspoon on Latter-day Faith, and talk about spiritual maturity, and about, you know, the relation was to ego needs, and that the ego needs drive, you know, being offended, the need to be right.
That's right.
But it seems to me that for a lot of people who are going through a lot of these struggles regarding whatever issue, is that, you know, they're in this kind of pain or hurt. And so how can they try to take this position of not being offended while still taking care of themselves? Like, there's an actual trauma or an actual pain that was caused to them.
Great question. And I do think this is really, really important. Because we can imagine that we just sit in our true selves all day, and truly it wouldn't be good necessarily for our human experience and for helping others, right? Because if I'm just sitting there not getting offended, I'm not paying attention to injustice in the world. I'm not paying attention to the things that are really difficult in healing the real trauma, right? Yeah, there's a balance to everything. You know, it's, and the reality is we can't get there anyway. It doesn't matter how long of a contemplative journey you've been on. I promise you, you are still going to be in your ego most of the time, probably, right? It's not that we're going to eliminate it. It's that we're going to recognize it. But it's really, really important as we do this to stay on the path of bringing light to those dark places. So it's not that we're just going to hold ourselves on a mountain totally up and away from it. We're actually going to recognize it, name it. But we do it with compassion. We do it with a way that doesn't just tear down what has hurt us. If you're going to tear down something evil, you need to have a way to also build it back up and bring us all to a higher place. We have to do it with clarity, and we have to do it with compassion. And tapping into that true self more often gives us the strength to do that. But we need our discerning ego minds, because this is one of the things we don't get. It is the value of anger, the value of sadness, the value of some of these things as we go through a faith journey or anything else. We need anger. How else would I know that there's something that's wrong that needs to be it needs to be corrected. You know, what it does is it shows me that I value myself, that I have anger, that I have those dark places. So I don't want to just totally be in my true self and never be offended, if that makes sense. But I need that as a touchstone to be able to take me into those places and not to allow the ego to take me to a complete place of powerlessness and victimhood. Right? So when working with people in trauma, The trick is to just touch the suffering in yourself and others. Just touch it. You don't invade and you don't abandon. And as we help each other heal, the more that we're able to do that for each other and just sit with people and not invade or abandon, the person in trauma will learn to not invade or abandon themselves. And the more we have access to that, the more we're going to have more access to that true self. It really is the source of healing. But it's not where you want to live your life. It's really not. We need the ego. Are we on time? We have time for one or two more?
Yeah, about 5 minutes.
Yeah, okay. So one in-depth one or two shorter ones? You're gonna come up. She's like, I don't want to come up. Oh.
I want a question, but I don't want to get up.
It's just curiosity. Yeah. I know in one of the podcasts, Mormon Matters, somebody asked Richard Rohr what he thought of Mormonism.
Oh, yes.
I love the answer.
Yeah. Those of us who have been at the Living School, Dan Witherspoon is here, is in the school. And we've got Marianne, who's starting next week. We're all going to be in Albuquerque together next week.
So has anybody else asked him again, and he's expanded on it?
I don't know how much he expanded on it with Dan. I mean, I was the one that originally just asked him and said, hey, you know, I mentioned, because I was asking these questions of him like, dude, I'm a woman in a hierarchical patriarchal, like, you know, in Falling Upward, you say that if you have two or three people, you can start to make a difference. I mean, do I have a shot? Is this a fool's errand? What am I doing? Right? And he did say, well, you're probably going to need more than two or three, just so you know. But probably you only need two or three per ward, you know? I think you can make a pretty good shift if you get a few of those. But, yeah, that's when he said to me, Mormonism, he's like, oh, Mormons. God bless Mormons. Yeah, he's like, you guys do first half of life better than anyone. Bar none. I really mean it. I mean, I do a good Richard impression. I really mean it. He said, but you have almost no second half of life. And I think that's true. It's our stage of development. It's our unbelievably good organization skills, our unbelievable order that gives us such a good first half of life. And boy, do we have a cardboard box to beat our way out of in order to get to that second half of life. And just the other thing, I told him how much he's resonating with progressive Mormonism, and he's like, Mormons? Oh my God, Mormons? And then he just said, tell them thank you.
A tiny quote from somebody who spoke at Sunstone ages ago. Somebody said, it's really great being a child of God. Mm-hmm. I want to be an adult of God.
Love that. Love that. Yeah, this is how we can adult. Alternative orthodoxy, adulting in Mormonism.
The first novel ever written, and the longest standing piece of classical literature, is Don Quixote de la Mancha.
Yeah.
He had a Sancho Panza. What you describe is being Don Quixote.
Yes, we need both. This is all about integration, right? Everything belongs. Yeah.
Okay, one quick question. Mm-hmm. On raising children unorthodox, how do you recommend going about giving them that first half of life and helping them transition to a second half?
Yeah, this is the grand mystery, right? I wish I had the perfect, like, map for that. I think we're still experimenting with it. Because truly, if you don't give them a good enough box, I mean, I've heard this from developmental scientists. I actually heard this particular anecdote from Tom McConkie, who works in development. But just talking about, you know, a feminist woman who was a single mom and raising her daughter to just, you know, have no bounds and you can do anything you want. And the girl goes off to college and joins a fundamentalist religion. Mom's worst nightmare. And you actually do see this. I have several friends that are actually in a similar place. So you do need the box. But, you know, actually, I was really inspired. For those of you who heard Reza Aslan the other night, he has some really interesting ideas about that, about exposing kids to different, he used the example of a well, you know, different wells. We're all trying to get to water. He doesn't really care which well his kids dig. And so he's showing all of these wells to his kids so that they can, you know, reach the water. So I think we can do this. Organized religion really helps. It really helps to have a community around this for your kids to see. But I just think we have to be really intentional about having boundaries. And you just want boundaries to be as large as they possibly can to keep people safe and to have an identity. And we have to have boundaries to run up against. If your teenager is not rebelling in some way, you probably need some stricter rules, because they need to be able to bump up against something to figure out who they are. So boundaries are good. It's good to have, you know, order and show at least some sort of a way of doing this. But I'm excited about the future and finding different ways to do that. And I just think organically things are going to spring up where we're finding ways to do this outside of, you know, if you're doing it outside of an Orthodox kind of a religion. Because, you know, it's easier to do in religion. I'll be honest, it's easier. But then you've got the paper bag or the cardboard box or something harder to punch out of eventually. So, you got? Yeah.
We still have time?
We're right at this.
Okay. Another time.
You know me.
Yeah.
You know. We can talk.
I'll quickly follow up on the Richard Rohr thing.
Yeah.
There were two of us in January that were with him in a group of about 40. And it came up that I was a Mormon, and he just did really do what Jana was like, you're kidding. Because, and so in front of this little group, this guy has beaten so many odds to get here, you know? And so my friend Jody and I, who were there, the other Mormon, we kind of thought to ourselves afterwards, we were talking, should we correct him on this? And we just decided... No. That's Richard's story, and so and just to let you know, there are 5 Mormons who are joining this new cohort next week. Yeah,
the Mormons of Storm in the Living School, come join us. Thank you.